Scientific naturalism is the view that our world is wholly a result of natural processes that follow the rules of ordinary science. There is no need for a creator, except perhaps to establish the rules, and apparent evidence for design and creation is only an illusion that demonstrates the power of natural unguided selection. Scientific naturalists insist that their view is scientific, in that the objective facts of science confirm it. In their view, nature shows no compelling evidence for a creator. If this seems strange to those who see the evidence for a caring creator all around us, the beauty and intricacy of creation, for example, it is because such things as beauty and design are dismissed as subjective, unscientific judgments. Scientific naturalism flourished as the age of science developed. By about 1900, it seemed to have triumphed, its success aided by some influential evangelists for the cause. As the Earth receded to an insignificant speck in the vastness of the cosmos, so the significance of mankind in the universe seemed also to recede to nothingness. And any claim for a creator or the special character of the human creature, or for a world specifically designed as the abode of mankind, seemed conceit and vanity. To maintain a creationist view in the face of scientific naturalism required considerable grit and determination, and perhaps stubbornness. But since about 1900, as science continued to grow and mature, the very methods and findings of science began to uncover challenges to the naturalist view. The discoveries, which have accelerated in recent years and continue to the present, increasingly suggest that the world we inhabit is the product of a rational thinking creator. At the present, the evidence is so powerful that to maintain the scientific naturalist view requires a stubborn determination to dismiss the strong contrary evidence. It is the aim of these remarks tonight to trace out this rise and fall of scientific naturalism. Prelude, in the beginning. One outcome of the Crusades was that Greek philosophy was reintroduced to the universities and seminaries of Europe after having been lost during the Dark Ages, and it came to have a strong influence on intellectual thought. Through the works of Thomas Aquinas and others, Greek philosophical thought was integrated into Christian doctrine. Of course, it must be understood that the Greek pantheon was at the opposite extreme from the monotheism of the church, so acceptance of the Greek intellectual achievements did not necessarily imply a belief in church doctrine. Indeed, throughout all ages, there have been scientists and scholars who maintained independence of thought from church dogma. Their independence of thought was sometimes more, sometimes less open, depending on the tolerance of their sponsors and the hold that the church had in the local societies. The Bible begins with the creation. God created the heavens and the earth, hanging the earth on nothing as a dwelling place for Adam, the father of the human race. The universe is not eternal. It had a beginning, and creation was designed for men's habitation and oversight. Man's place in creation is central. With this understanding, it's natural that the church adopted the Greek scientist Ptolemy's earth-centered model of the universe, which he developed in the second century AD. It was, moreover, the most advanced and successful scientific achievement of antiquity, and had demonstrated the ability to make remarkably accurate predictions of the movements of heavenly bodies, and in particular, predictions of solar and lunar eclipses. The church accepted the conclusions of the most advanced science of its day, not only accepted, but incorporated it into official church doctrine because it was also consistent with the Bible's creation account. Indeed, given the state of science at the time, the Ptolemaic model was the simplest, most direct affirmation of the biblical doctrine of the central position of man in creation. Ptolemy's universe had a motionless, non-rotating earth at its center. He fit the astronomical data to that kind of a model by having the planets and the stars follow circular orbits, such as those shown in this figure. Over the years, some adjustments were made to Ptolemy's model. There were lots of parameters that could be fine-tuned. So that by the Middle Ages, it was quite accurate in its predictions of the planetary positions and agreed very well with naked eye observations that were available at the time. A model with a spinning Earth together with planets orbiting the Sun, a so-called central fire, on circular tracks, had been proposed and rejected by Aristotle, and then proposed again by Aristarchus of Samos around 250 BC. But such a model did not seem reasonable for a number of reasons. Would we not feel a sense of motion if the Earth were spinning? What keeps it spinning? These questions, of course, are based on a misunderstanding of physics, but they are quite understandable. It's likely that many people even today don't know the answers. Looking ahead, almost certainly Copernicus would not have known the answers to these questions. Most likely he just ignored them, which of course is no answer at all. Or perhaps that's one of the reasons why Copernicus treated his work as just a mathematical convenience with no necessary connection with reality. The final answers didn't come until Galileo did his famous experiments over 100 years later. When I ponder this, I come to the startling thought that I might well have opposed Copernicus if I were an academic scholar in his day, and not only for religious reasons. I would have argued that his solution is not well thought out and leaves too many loose ends, which it was and does. And then there's the clincher. How could the fixed stars remain fixed if the Earth orbited the Sun? Such a thing would imply that the distance to the fixed stars is incredibly huge in order to have no apparent motion over the diameter of the Earth's orbit. Such immense distances were so far beyond human experience as to be unbelievable. One should note that there is no basic conflict between a sun-centered universe and church theology, except for the fact that the church unwisely incorporated Ptolemy's universe into its dogma. In the 5th century AD, Augustine had remarked, and Luther later affirmed over 1,000 years later, that the biblical accounts are written as they would appear to a man standing on earth, and that specific statements should be understood that way. Augustine illustrated his view with a few examples from the creation account, day 4 in particular, but I do not know whether he would extend this to statements about the sun rising in the east and setting in the west as we would today. Ptolemy's system had a fixed earth, so the sun literally did rise and fall. Augustine also noted that this church should not take positions on obscure scientific views and interpretations of biblical text, but should allow for different views. Unfortunately, that good advice was not followed. Next, the rise and fall, the rise of scientific naturalism, Copernicus to 1900. Martin Luther said in his table talks, "We are at the dawn of a new era, for we are beginning to recover the knowledge of the external world that was lost through the fall of Adam. We now observe creatures properly. But by the grace of God, we already recognize in the most delicate flower the wonders of divine goodness and omnipotence." Nicholas Copernicus and Martin Luther were contemporaries in the early 1500s. In 1514, Copernicus developed a model for the solar system, in effect rediscovering the work of Aristarchus. His model was not quite as accurate at prediction as the well-tuned Ptolemaic system, but it was much easier to use in astronomical calculations. Eventually, the Copernican model, not the Ptolemaic one, was used in preparation of the Gregorian calendar in 1582, under Pope Gregory XIII, replacing the earlier Julian calendar. Our modern calendar is based on the Gregorian calendar. Martin Luther's colleague, Philip Melanchthon, sent a young scholar, Joachim Rheticus, to study under Copernicus. Rheticus urged Copernicus to publish his work, which he did in 1543, shortly before his work. In other words, Copernicus had developed a model in 1514, but it wasn't published, partly because of opposition from the church, but Rheticus urged Copernicus to publish his work. Some argue that Luther was opposed to the Copernican system, based on a single offhand remark quoted in table talks. However, without the urging of Luther's colleagues, Copernicus would not have published his model of the solar system, and it is largely Protestant support in the face of official Catholic opposition that led to the beginnings of modern astronomy and the ultimate capitulation of the Church. Tycho Brahe, born shortly before Copernicus died, devoted a lifetime to the preparation of more accurate star charts. He built an observatory with the Protestant Danish King Frederick's funding on the island of Hven, just off Elsinore in Denmark, is the home of Shakespeare's Hamlet. Tycho's measurements are accurate to 1 arc minute, equivalent to a 1-inch error at 100 yards, about what a really good marksman can achieve with the naked eye. His quadrant had a 7-foot radius, as shown in this picture. The readings were so accurate that they were sensitive to traffic moving past the observatory, so he built a second observatory underground to avoid traffic vibrations. Johannes Kepler was a young protege of Tycho, and at age 29 carried on Tycho's work after Tycho's death in 1601. Kepler struggled for about 10 years to find a model of the solar system that agreed with Tycho's data, concentrating on the orbit of Mars, which deviates from a circular orbit more than other nearby planets. The problem was that Tycho's data were so accurate that deviations of any proposed mathematical model, his own or Copernicus's, could not be explained away by as a measurement error. Now this picture shows a circular orbit, which is what Copernicus assumed, and the dots are, the solid circles are the elliptical orbit, and the dots are what the equivalent circular orbit would look like. And the Brahe's data was so accurate that at certain places on the orbit, you could distinguish between motion on the circle and motion on the ellipse. And Tycho took a long time to figure out what the problem was. Finally, after 10 years of intense effort, Kepler discovered the answer. Using Tycho's data, he published New Astronomy in 1609, which asserts that the planets, using the example of Mars, follow elliptical orbits. This is Kepler's first law for planetary orbits, one of 3 laws that characterize the orbits of the planets. This was the same year that Galileo first used a telescope for astronomical observations, invented just the previous year. With the publication of Kepler's laws and the discoveries of Galileo, the geocentric model of the solar system came under serious attack. No longer could a Copernicus hide behind the excuse that this is just an exercise in mathematics. The evidence from the data showed otherwise. Now an Occam's razor argument clearly pointed to the Kepler solution. The geocentric cosmology was doomed, although it took most of the 17th century for the details to play out. The power and simplicity of Newton's universal law of gravity finally triumphed with a clear explanation of the physical reason for elliptical orbits. Kepler thought that his work glorified God, remarking, quote, "Observe how through my effort God is being celebrated," unquote. But not everyone shared his view. Not only did the Earth lose its central position in the universe, but the accepted size of the universe grew enormously. The Earth was minuscule in comparison. Thus the Earth, and by implication life and humans, were deposed from a central position in creation. Martin Luther's New Era appeared to question the centrality of the human creation in the natural scheme of things. Galileo's measurements showed that stars are very distant, that the Milky Way has innumerable stars. The Earth and the solar system are just a small part of a much larger universe. Next, the beginnings of modern physics between 1650 and 1700 and the clockwork universe. And I'm going to quote a paragraph from John Milton's Paradise Lost, which he put into Adam's mouth before the fall in the story. When I behold this goodly frame, this world of heaven and earth consisting, and compute their magnitudes, this earth a spot, a grain, an atom, with the firmament compared, and all her numbered stars that seem to roll spaces incomprehensible, for such their distances argues and their swift return diurnal, merely to officiate light around this spacious earth, this punctual spot, one day and night in all their vast survey, useless besides. Reasoning, I often admire, which means wonder or marvel, how nature, wise and frugal, could commit such disproportions with superfluous hand, so many nobler bodies to create, greater so manifold to this one use, for odd appears. Milton wrote Paradise Lost in 1667. Adam's skepticism expressed here reflects every man's dilemma at the time. Midway between Galileo and Newton, the world was well aware that appearances seemed to clash with church teachings. Is not the incomprehensible vastness of space and the stars, the nobler bodies, out of proportion to the one use, merely to officiate light, that these stars serve? Does it not seem to be disproportions with superfluous hand, if by a wise and frugal nature? These words put into Adam's mouth before the fall show that he's already contemplating things that may imply that God's account to him is not trustworthy, the seeds of doubt that the serpent exploited in Eve. In fact, it would be 300 years, the mid-1900s, before science could satisfactorily answer Adam's dilemma. About 80 years after Kepler formulated his laws of planetary motion, Newton showed that they are consequences of his famous law of gravitation, a result published in 1687. It immediately became evident that Newton's laws apply everywhere in the universe, and in one amazing insight, the motions and interactions of the entire universe suddenly became clear. Philosophers of his day, Voltaire, Spinoza, Locke, and others, quickly saw the implications of a universe that is governed by mechanical laws. The view came to be known as the clockwork universe. Everything operates naturally according to predetermined laws. The task of the scientist is simply to describe these laws, and then the secrets of the universe will be revealed. In such a clockwork world, some would argue, there is no need for God. The beginnings of modern chemistry and biology, 1700 to 1800. The next century after Newton was a time of further simplification. All chemicals were shown to be composed of a small number of unchangeable elements which occur in fixed proportions. It's hard to overstate how this clarified the confusing complexity of the chemical science that had its roots in alchemy. By the early 1800s, even the chemicals in living matter were found to be made up of ordinary elements, mainly hydrogen, carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. The need to assume that there is some mystical life force and organic substances passed as the understanding of chemistry increased. If the physical and chemical worlds can be described in a few laws and a handful of elements, can the biological world be far behind? Perhaps all of nature runs mechanically like clockwork. What is the need for a divine creator, particularly if matter and the universe are themselves eternal? Some contemporary philosophers speculated along these lines. Galileo's research used the telescope invented by Hans Lippershey in 1608 and quickly applied by Galileo and others to study the heavens. The microscope had actually been invented a bit earlier, in 1590, by a 10-year-old boy named Zacharias Janssen. But this discovery was not well publicized until it was reinvented by Hans Lippershey in 1609. The microscope led to the discovery of the world of microbes and the realization that life extends from the visible to the microscopic. This is a picture of the very first, it was actually a single lens like microscope used by von Leeuwenhoek to discover to first observe bacteria. He was the first one to observe bacteria. It wasn't actually observed by a compound microscope until almost 100 years later. Although von Leeuwenhoek had such a reputation with the Royal Society of London that I guess you might say they believed him. He had very sharp eyes, too, incidentally. Around the mid-1700s, several scientists began the immense task of a systematic description of all animals and plant life. It became clear that plants and animals can be grouped by similar body plans, and that there is a kind of sameness between species that superficially seem quite different. Linnaeus and Buffon cataloged many thousands of species. Linnaeus organized them into the familiar groupings, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, a general classification system based on physical similarities that is still followed today. The phyla distinguished different overall body plans, and the other divisions concerned progressively finer distinctions within the body plans. The classification based on similar appearance can be loosely arranged in a tree-like structure of increasing complexity. This gave rise to contention between those who believed that this tree implied physical descent, Lamarck and Voltaire, for example, and those, Buffon and Linnaeus, and many geologists later, who argued that there remain unbridgeable gaps, a position called essentialism. This argument continued up to the time of Darwin's Origin of Species, which argued that all living species descend from common ancestors. Many scientists took this view to mean that all species of life came about by purely natural means with no need for divine intervention. The beginning of modern geology and the record of the rocks. This is a quote by William Smith, I believe a note written in his diary in 1796. Fossils have been long studied as great curiosities, collected with great pains, treasured with great care, and at great expense, and shown and admired with as much pleasure as a child's hobby horse is shown and admired by himself and his playfellows because it is pretty. And this has been done by thousands who have never paid the least regard to that wonderful order and regularity with which nature has composed these singular productions and assigned to each class its peculiar stratum. The most astounding discovery at the end of the 18th century was the realization that the Earth's rock formations contain a detailed and systematic record of Earth's history that can be traced all the way back to a time before the beginnings of visible life. The fossil record also shows a progression in species complexity over this time and records the first appearance of major plant and animal groups. Now, this is impossible to see from up there, but this is the modern version of the Tree of Life. And actually, I have the book that came from on the table here. You can look at it later. I could spend half an hour just talking about this because it is not a tree. As I'm sure Bob Newman and others will point out to you, it is, or let's put it this way, it's lots of branches sort of hanging on nothing, okay? And that is a Stephen Jay Gould's version of the modern understanding of where and when life came about. This progression in complexity parallels to a remarkable degree the classification schemes of Linnaeus and Buffon, a fact that Charles Darwin used later to argue for natural descent. This message contained in the rocks was first described by William Smith, a canal and mining engineer, in 1799, some decades after the works of Buffon and Linnaeus first appeared. In that year, it was first publicly recognized that rocks preserve a detailed record of Earth's ancient history. It was perhaps a fortunate accident that the geological formations of Great Britain span nearly the full range of the fossil record of visible animals. From the outcroppings of the very earliest Cambrian fossils in the northwest of Scotland to the recent times in the vicinity of London on the southeast. This gave William Smith the ability to get an overall view of things in his travels over Wales, Great Britain, and Scotland. After Smith's revelation in 1799, the same rock classifications were discovered to hold worldwide, and over the next century, the geological character of virtually all of the accessible landmass worldwide was systematically explored. The geologist Charles Lyell provided much of the theoretical explanation for the new findings in geology. He introduced the notion of uniformitarianism and argued that the present appearance of the Earth's surface is due to slow changes over very long periods of time. From his systematic study of sedimentary rock, he concluded that the Earth is very old and that its surface crust floats on a molten interior. He argued very carefully in two extensively documented books. Because his conclusions contradicted what scientists thought they knew about the sun's heat generation and the Earth's heat retention. Lyell's very careful argument carried the day, even though the contradiction with well-established physics was not resolved until almost a century later, when the vast energy production of nuclear fission and fusion was better understood. Fossils played an essential role in this conclusion that the Earth is very old. An early French geologist, Georges Cuvier, remarked, quote, "Without fossils, we could never have surmised that there were successive epochs in the formation of the globe." Interlude, the height of scientific naturalism. Is not man an unimportant bit of dust in an unimportant planet, in an unimportant galaxy, in an unimportant region, somewhere in the vastness of space? The cumulative effect of these discoveries in astronomy, physics, biology, and geology is that life, and mankind in particular, appear to have been dethroned from a position of central importance in creation. The advances of science led to a secular triumphalism that appeared to eliminate any need to consider, and indeed seemed to argue against, divine providence in creation. Physics showed that the universe appears to be described by a few deterministic laws, by which the motions of the stars and the planets are determined far into the past and the future. Chemistry showed that the organic chemicals are not essentially different from inorganic ones, that organic chemicals can be formed from inorganic chemicals, so there appears to be no life force that distinguishes one from the other. Biology showed a relatedness in all forms of plant and animal life. From geology, it appeared that life extends back in time over vast eons, and that the fossils show gradual progressions in development. Man appears to be only the latest stage in a long tree of life. This seems to be supported by a biology, which shows the relatedness of all kinds of life in terms of similar body plans and body parts. All this seemed to argue against the idea that there is something special or extraordinary about the Earth, and about life and mankind in particular. Surely an Occam's razor argument would point toward the ordinariness, if not inevitability, of life and mankind. And mankind is a remarkable accident in a small corner of the vast universe. Thoughts of man's special place in creation were relegated by many scientists to the dustbin of dead religious superstition. Now, this is where I should just stop and say, okay, we'll come back next month and talk about the rest of the story. Next part of the talk, second part of my talk, is the fall of scientific naturalism from 1900 to the present. I'm quoting Robert Jastrow, who is an astrophysicist. "For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries." I find that's kind of humorous. I don't know what Robert Jastrow thought. For a change of pace, we will now move ahead to the present and look back to see how the evidence in favor of scientific naturalism has radically changed. But before that, I would like to mention two books that came out shortly after 1900. These books rediscovered themes that had been lost or overlooked since the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859. Darwin's book caused a revolution of thought that almost overnight threw out decades of prior work which pointed to evidence of design in nature. The preeminent example of this earlier work was the 12-volume publication known as the Bridgewater Treatises, published in the 1830s. The evidence was not refuted, as much as it was, quote, ignored and brushed away, unquote, as Lydia Miller, widow of a prominent geologist, Hugh Miller, lamented. One of the first acts of the 20th century was to reconsider some arguments along lines that were reminiscent of that pre-Darwinian period. The first book was Man's Place in the Universe by Alfred Russel Wallace, published in 1903. This book examines the question of whether life is common in the universe, a view often held by those who believe that life arose by chance. He concludes, after a review of the physical and chemical requirements, that the Earth is unique in the universe as a habitat suitable for the production of advanced life, and that to produce such a habitat, quote, such a vast and complex universe as that which we know exists around us may have been absolutely required, unquote. He used probability arguments that consider the special conditions that must be satisfied in such a habitat. This is an early expression of what became known as the anthropic principle, the observation that the universe and the Earth are uniquely fit for the existence of advanced life. With this book, Wallace directly refutes the common but naive view that the insignificance of the Earth in comparison with the universe implies the insignificance of life, and in particular of the human creation. The second book, coming in 1913, is The Fitness of the Environment by Lawrence J. Henderson. Henderson focuses his attention on the physical and chemical properties of the common materials of life. The book concludes that the elements found in living matter, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, carbon, and a handful more, and of water and carbon dioxide and a few other compounds formed from these elements, are essential to have life of any kind. They have unusual combinations of physical and chemical properties that are uniquely suited for life. By this, he refutes the notion, popular even then, that various alien life forms could exist, which are based on substantially different materials. Water, for example, is uniquely suited for life in many of its physical and chemical attributes. For one thing, water is the most nearly perfect solvent, and this ability is essential to life. But this is only one of the properties that are used in essential ways by living matter itself or in a life-supporting environment, and that set water apart from any other known material. Carbon, the backbone of the vast majority of organic compounds, nearly equals water in its marvelous properties that are exploited by all living species, in particular the ability to form long chain molecules that carry out nearly all the functions of life, and in the remarkable properties of carbon dioxide and its carbonic acid form, which are essential to cell metabolism. Henderson's book has stood the test of time and is often cited even today. He extends the anthropic principle introduced by Wallace to the chemistry of life by itemizing the many peculiar, apparently tailor-made properties of life's basic building materials. Clearly, life is very special and makes heavy use of very unusual features found in these materials. Henderson acknowledges that much of his line of reasoning originated in the, quote, forgotten literature of natural theology, unquote, referring in particular to the Bridgewater treatises. This literature vanished from the scene when Darwin's Origin of Species appeared, and the hypothesis of purpose, again using Henderson's words, was forgotten. A hypothesis that, quote, even skeptics were nearly or quite unable, however strong their desire, to account for the facts with a plausible theory, unquote. Henderson's book revived and extended many of the same arguments that had been developed in this forgotten literature. The book's concluding sentence is, quote, the biologist may now rightly regard the universe in its very essence as biocentric, unquote. In summary, Wallace and Henderson argued that the perception of Earth's insignificance in this universe, or as John Milton put it, this world of heaven and earth consisting and compute their magnitudes, this earth a spot, a grain, an atom, with the firmament compared, that perception is false. Factually, the earth may be all of that, and yet the universe, large and majestic as it is, serves the earth and life itself and constrains its own scope of vision to accommodate Earth's. These books worked in the same milieu as the contemporary science of 1900, now let's jump ahead to the present and look back over the past century and see how scientific naturalism has fared with the advances that science has seen in that time. First, let's look at Adam's dilemma, that skeptical query which John Milton put into the mouth of Adam. What are the stars for? Why such disproportions with superfluous hand, so many nobler bodies to create? In the century that has passed since 1900, the worlds of general relativity and nuclear physics have been added to science. General relativity led indirectly to the Big Bang, the recognition that the universe had a beginning. The universe is large, but not infinite, and the time since creation can be measured with some precision. Nuclear physics has led to an understanding of what goes on inside stars. The stars and the death of stars and cataclysmic supernova explosions are where the elements, other than primordial hydrogen and helium, are created. The primordial elements, hydrogen and helium, were mostly formed within the first few minutes after the Big Bang. The general details of these creation processes are now well known. It shows the structure of a pre-nova star, and you'll see that in just before a supernova occurs, you have the creation of hydrogen and helium are primordial. You have carbon and oxygen and neon and magnesium and silicon, and in the middle you have iron, or the iron group, could be nickel. So this is where the elements are created. And then, next slide, it shows a supernova. In fact, this happens to be the Crab Nebula, which was a supernova in 1054 AD and was noted by Chinese astronomers in particular. I don't know if any Western astronomers noted it or not, but it was noted by the Chinese astronomers as a guest star, I think they called it. This is what it looks like today, the Crab Nebula. And it is in supernovas of that sort that the heavier elements in iron are created. The matter that makes up the Earth was formed in the interior of a star, which went through its life cycle, generating the elements up to the iron group, and then died in a supernova explosion, which generated the heavier elements through uranium. The Sun is at least a second-generation star, with the planets of the solar system formed from the ashes of a supernova explosion. Any life-supporting star would have to be at least second generation. Thus, Adam's universe expanding at the speed of light long enough to see the birth and death of at least one generation of stars and the birth and maturation of another generation, a process that would require billions of years, from this perspective, the universe is not disproportionate in size. In fact, it's relatively young, since only a very few generations of stars could have passed since the Big Bang. The many nobler bodies of John Milton are similarly engaged in producing the very dust from which Adam was made. Nothing is disproportionate and superfluous, although John Milton would have to wait 300 years to learn this. Along with the discovery of how the universe itself and the elements were created, nuclear scientists have made remarkable new discoveries which show how biocentric the universe had to be in order to be a dwelling place for mankind. There are many of these instances of fine-tuning that can be cited. I will briefly mention just a few to give a flavor of the kind of argument used. To start back in the beginning, if antimatter were not very slightly more unstable than matter, then the material universe would not exist. Nobody knows why this asymmetry should exist. And in fact, the first evidence of it, discovered in the 1950s, shocked the physics world. Second, the force of gravity is vastly less than the electrical force, again, for totally inexplicable reasons. However, if either force were more than a few percent different from its actual value, the Earth and life would be impossible. Similar remarks can be made about the values of the strong and weak nuclear forces, two forces that are discovered in high-energy experiments. These are the forces that hold the nucleus together, despite strongly repulsive electrical forces between the protons. Another example of fine-tuning was discovered, or actually predicted and then discovered, by Nobel physicist Fred Hoyle in 1950. He was puzzled by the formation of carbon when the stars burn. It seemed to require the triple collision of three heliums, which physics calculations show is a very rare event. Without going into technical details, if it were not for the fact that carbon and oxygen have resonances at certain precise energy levels that can be computed, then either no carbon would have formed, and hence no carbon-based life, or else all the carbon would have fused into oxygen and higher elements, and hence no carbon-based life. In contemplating this, Hoyle remarked, "A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates in the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion almost beyond question." In 1983, John Barrow and Frank Kippler wrote The Anthropic Cosmological Principle. I have the book here if you want to look through it, which documents some examples of this fine-tuning. Frank Kippler later remarked, "When I began my career as a cosmologist 20 years ago, I was a convinced atheist. I never in my wildest dreams imagined that one day I would be writing a book purporting to show that the essential claims of Judeo-Christian theology are in fact true, that these claims are straightforward deductions of the laws of physics as we now understand them. I have been forced into these conclusions by the inexorable logic of my own special branch of physics." And reacting to this fine-tuning, Princeton physicist Freeman Dyson writes in his book, Disturbing the Universe, "The more I examine the universe and the details of its architecture, the more evidence I find that the universe, in some sense, must have known we were coming." The existence of fine-tuning implies that the underlying physics and chemistry of the universe is designed with the creation of life in view, a conclusion that Henderson had come to 60 years earlier. This is, of course, a heavy blow to scientific naturalism. No longer can naturalists confidently point to science for support of their view. Rather, they have to consciously sidestep the implications of design that are part of this fine-tuning. It's hard to decide which other discoveries of the past century are the most relevant to the question of scientific naturalism, but I think I must place very high the electron microscope, which was invented by Ernst Ruska in 1931, following up an audacious suggestion by Louis de Broglie in 1924 that not only photons, but electrons, and all other matter for that matter, have a wave-particle duality. You understand that sometimes you think of photons as being waves, sometimes you think of them as being particles. And in fact, they're wave particles. And so are electrons. And so are you and I. Okay. So is the moon. So is the sun. That first electron microscope led to a series of improved microscopes which today allow scientists to examine what goes on at many levels of magnification, even down to the level of individual atoms. What do you put the next one up? I think I have the cue a little bit in the wrong place here. Yeah, this is a. This shows the relative size and the humans down to wasps, the hair, the cells, the bacteria, the viruses, and the light microscope can only see down to about down here. And so the electron microscope can see all the way down to even small molecules. And there are other, since the invention of the electron microscope, there are a number of varieties of microscopes that are just truly ingenious and exotic. And they can see down to individual atoms. I think there's a famous picture of IBM, of the name IBM on a crystal, where the IBM is actually a molecule, atoms, is atoms that have actually been placed into the tidbit to spell out IBM. Atoms, individual atoms. In 1900, progress in observing the microscopic world was blocked by the limitations of the light microscope. At the highest light microscope resolutions, the bulk of a living cell appeared to be an amorphous, undifferentiated blob of jelly. Some small bacteria were barely visible, and viruses were entirely invisible. At that time, it was thought that this was an insuperable limit. The inability to examine the finest details of living matter in 1900 led, ironically, to the view that things must be simple down there, which led in turn to a gross underestimation of the vast complexity found in even the simplest living species. In a sense, this misjudgment was understandable. Progress in physics and chemistry showed that the complex material world is based on a few relatively straightforward principles. Even the formidable world of organic chemistry was shown to be just ordinary chemistry. So it was reasonably thought, time would show that life is based on some relatively simple principles that would be discovered in due time, but just the opposite occurred. What is less understandable is that even today, scientists who should know better still carry on the myth that the generation of simple life is almost inevitable, given the right conditions. By the 1970s, microscopes were able to examine the fine details of protoplasm and revealed fine structure and functions that were previously impossible to imagine. Next slide. Today, we know that the eukaryotic cells, that is, cells that have a nucleus, and which are generally much larger than bacterial cells, are able to function because the protoplasm contains an extensive cytoskeleton that provides structural support, contracts and twists like muscles, and forms pathways for motor kinesin molecules shown here that literally walk along carrying food and waste between specialized organelles and between them and the cell wall. After the talk, I have some animations which I just got down from the internet showing some of these things working. The food mechanism of eukaryotes, the cells that have a nucleus, contrasts with bacteria, which rely exclusively on diffusion to move food and waste through the cell interior. As a result, there is a practical limit to the size of bacteria, determined by diffusion rates and cell metabolism, and it's around 5 microns, which is 5 millionths of a meter. It's very small. The kinesin, nucleated cells can be much larger because they have this transport system built into them. The kinesin follows a microtubule pathway, a compact spiral of two-piece molecules, the red-green pair in this illustration. One kinesin foot is attracted to one end of the molecule, which causes the other foot to span the molecule, touch the next molecule on the path, and then release the first foot. In this way, it advances along. Minute, delicately balanced electrical forces of attraction and repulsion cause the feet to move. The cell's organelles are controlled environments that perform various specialized tasks as part of the overall cell metabolism. The cell walls, and more generally the membranes that enclose the cell contents, are themselves marvels of complexity, with very specialized molecules that act as gatekeepers to admit or exclude various kinds of matter. There are many specialized motor molecules that are found in living matter. We've already mentioned kinesin. It moves along the track. A rotary motor is found in E. coli bacteria. It has a whip-like flagellum with a complex electric motor fixed at its base where the flagellum passes through the cell wall. The motor can spin the flagellum at high speed in either direction and reverse direction in a small fraction of a second. At first, the discovery of this motor was in the early 80s, I think, was met with great skepticism. It was thought that the flagellum did not rotate, but simply whipped back and forth. But the proof came when a scientist found a way to glue the flagellum to a glass slide, and when this happened, you could see the bacterium spinning around the flagellum. Like a helicopter, if you hold the rotors, you watch the helicopter turn around the opposite direction. A third kind of motor is used in photosynthetic bacteria and in plants. This motor, called ATP synthase, manufactures the energy storage molecule called ATP. The motor is fixed in a membrane, and a flow of protons passes through it, causing it to spin. Every time the motor spins a cycle, 3 molecules of ATP are formed. And I have an animation of ATP that we can show later too. A fourth kind of motor is a specialized molecule called DNA helicase that walks along the DNA as it splits apart a double spiral while transcribing the genetic code. Life is not possible without these and similar levels of complexity. How is it possible to imagine that these intricate details of the cell, which all have to work in order to carry on life's basic functions, could form as a result of mindless chance? Suddenly, scientific naturalism doesn't look so scientifically compelling. The genetic code in the central dogma. In 1900, the complex way that genetic information is recorded in the cell was completely unknown. Since the systematic study of biology began in the 1700s, scientists sought to know how a cell stores and passes on its genetic information. The work of Mendel, which passed unnoticed for many years, and others show that there are statistical rules that can predict how certain traits are passed on, but this did not provide much information about how or where the information is stored and how the information is used to guide cell metabolism. Eventually, in 1944, DNA, a complex molecule found in every functioning cell, was singled out as the main, if not only, storage place for genetic information. And in 1953, Watson and Crick solved the basic structure. DNA is a long double-strand spiral, a ladder-like molecule that links together thousands of other molecules called nucleotides, which form the rungs of the ladder. There are four kinds of nucleotides, often represented by the letters U, C, A, and T. Long segments of these nucleotides code for the genes that build all of the cell's specialized molecules, including themselves. A sequence of three nucleotide codes for a single amino acid. With four nucleotides available, there are thus 4 × 4 × 4 equals 64 possible triplet combinations. Each combination codes for one of the 20 amino acids or indicates the beginning or end of a particular gene. The amino acids then form proteins that directly or indirectly conduct all of the cell's activity. All of life, from the lowliest viruses and bacteria to the most complex plants and animals, use this same digital scheme, with minor variations, to record and transcribe its genetic information. A description of the complete and very complex building process from the gene to the DNA to the protein product is called the central dogma, a term coined by Francis Crick in 1958. A cell cannot carry on its life functions without this complete process in place. Over 150 genes with a total length of over 150,000 base pairs are needed just to build up the complex molecules required to carry out the central dogma. And this assumes that the nucleotides and amino acids are already present and available in the right amounts. If not, then additional genes are needed to manufacture them. Since all life follows the same central dogma, it follows that this is a bare minimum size, the DNA of the very simplest imaginable self-reproducing life form. The extreme complexity of all living species should be a bit unsettling to those who hold to undirected natural evolution. The question naturally arises whether this complexity is necessary or whether it just reflects the piling up of billions of years of evolution. In 1998, the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences held a symposium to look at theoretical lower limits to the complexity of life. The symposium had the title, Size Limits of Very Small Microorganisms. The report was published in 2000. The context of this symposium was a controversy over earlier claims by some NASA scientists that they had found Mars fossils and a meteorite fragment. This controversy centered on the minute size of these fossils and whether they were large enough to contain the molecules that would be necessary to carry on the basic life functions. To give you an idea of how big the Mars fossils are, you look at this, that little thing there, that's the size of the Mars fossil, and this is the size of the smallest known bacteria. Genitalium, I believe. So a Mars fossil is minute compared with the smallest known living species of life. The context of the, the conclusion of the conference was that the Mars fossils are too small, and therefore they're not fossils, and they are not valid evidence of life on Mars. The symposium looked at size limits dictated by the physical and chemical as well as biological considerations, so it was a genuine cross-discipline effort. The conclusion is free-living organisms require a minimum of 250 to 450 proteins along with the genes and ribosomes necessary for their synthesis. A sphere having a certain diameter, 250 nanometers, is a reasonable lower size limit for life as we know it. A biosphere consisting entirely of ultra-small organisms is highly implausible. And 250 nanometers, that's about the size of the genitalium. So that pill over there is, according to these findings of the symposium, about as small as you're going to get for a living organization, an organism that can actually survive. There are even other limitations which we won't mention. Such a living organism must have genetic code with a length of at least several hundred thousand base pairs. In addition, these genes must be precise and interact in very specific, subtle ways, or life will quickly die out. The question that this poses for scientific naturalists is, how does the first such minimal life get started? How is it possible to even imagine such a subtle but extensive structure coming together by undirected random chance? In fact, a similar question was posed to mathematicians in 1966, long before this symposium, with the conclusion that such random production is an incredibly improbable event. Even so, some of the prominent apologists for science, such as Stephen Jay Gould and Carl Sagan, still asserted through their lives that life must be abundant in the universe, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Finally, let's look at the geological record of life. The geology that followed William Smith's discovery primarily concerned the Phanerozoic era, that is, the era of visible fossils. All the major phyla of animal and plant life show up as complete multicellular fossils in the Cambrian rock formations. Over the next century, ancient life forms have been found in earlier formations. At the present time, the earliest observed fossils are about 3.5 billion years old, and there is indirect evidence of life existing as early as 3.8 to 3.9 billion years ago. Since the Earth didn't cool off sufficiently until about 4 billion years ago, the implication is that life began almost immediately, as soon as the physical conditions would allow it to survive. This is a big problem for scientific naturalists because it does not allow the long expanses of empty time needed for chance combinations of amino acids or any other building blocks to build up the random structures that would become living matter. Compounding this problem is the fact that the earliest actual fossils appear to be photosynthetic. Photosynthesis is a complex process that is built around a chlorophyll molecule, a process one would think of very advanced, highly developed bacteria, not the very first ones to appear on Earth. One step in photosynthesis is the production of the universal energy-storing molecule ATP and involves the complex molecule ATP synthase and molecular motor. Nitrogen fixing is another complex process that earliest life must have had to invent. It involves the complex molecule nitrogenase, but for it to work, nitrogen fixing must be isolated from oxygen, which is a waste product of photosynthesis. Thus, still more complexity is required to allow nitrogen fixing to take place in specialized cells. The problem for scientific naturalism is to explain how all of this happened by chance almost instantly as soon as the Earth could support life. The net effect of these discoveries in the 20th century is that most knowledgeable scientists have realized that the very occurrence of life in this universe is a miraculous event, although they may not use that term. The universe is exceedingly hostile to life. Except for the Earth, there does not appear to be any place in the universe where life, in particular advanced life, could develop. In an interview celebrating his 100th birthday, Ernst Mayr was asked about the SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He remarked, there are two groups of people. The ones who believe that SETI will be successful and the ones who are quite sure it won't. Well, most scientists, and particularly biologists, are totally convinced it will not be successful. One day I said to Ed Wilson, how can you support spending money for this search when it's so totally impossible that there will be intelligent life? He smiled and said, oh, I know that. I realize this is totally improbable. If you ask why most scientists are totally convinced that SETI will not be successful, the answer is that they know that the natural development of something as complex as advanced life is extremely unlikely. So unlikely, in fact, it seems silly and naive even to entertain the possibility. Ironically, many of these scientists will take the opposite view and argue that simple life may appear frequently in the universe. Everywhere someone finds evidence of liquid water, someone's suggesting that we should look for life. Conclusion. From a position of strength, in 1900, scientific naturalism has not fared well in the face of extensive evidence that our universe and Earth and life itself exhibits all the hallmarks of careful design and execution. We've only hit a few highlights that could be amplified with many more examples. Predictably, perhaps those who dislike the intrusion of theological concepts in science react to this with ridicule or amusement. Anthony Flew, a prominent atheist, remarked in a recent interview, "It seems to me that the case for an Aristotelian God who has the characteristics of power and also intelligence is now much stronger than it ever was before." But despite this statement, I doubt he would call it an admission, he appears not to have made a fundamental change in his personal views. He was an atheist, a famous atheist. In the recent introduction to his book, God and Philosophy, which was still in preparation at the time of the interview, Flew qualifies this by the words, "Those who already judge that they have good reason to have reached theistic conclusions may very reasonably see these facts as further and strong confirmation of these conclusions. The others," Flew remarks, "just view them as brute facts with no further implications." Regardless of Flew's views, some scientists over the years who earlier viewed themselves as atheists have come to see from these brute facts that evidence for a creator is very powerful, and some have abandoned atheism to affirm a faith in God. Scientific naturalism no longer holds the high ground in objective science as it did in 1900. A fair assessment today would say that an Occam's razor argument would favor a creator. Thank you very much.
Where would you start working, or have scientists work to create a logic of intelligent design? And what would you design? Where would you look? And how would you go about doing it?
Well, I think the fact is the evidence is there, but there is willful disregard for the evidence. Personally, I'm not convinced that just having a lot of money to invest in some kind of project is going to do very much. In fact, there are people who are working in those areas. Philip Johnson and several others are working heavily in intelligent design theory. Where would I put my money? I really don't know. I think the what I am doing personally is simply trying to marshal the arguments that are abundantly there, and we're building the IBRI website, and we're going to do more of that to try to build up the case for people who are seekers. I think that people like Stephen Jay Gould and Carl Sagan, they simply aren't secrets. And I don't think any amount of information or clue. I don't think any amount of information is going to change your mind. I may be, you know, God can do anything. But I guess in a sense, if I may be just totally honest, I think that the example that we have of money being poured into research institutes to argue with young Earth, for example, has been almost a curse. And I don't think money is the answer. Now, it would be nice to have the $1,000 a year it takes to support the website and things of that sort, you know, that to make sure it keeps on going. But that we're not talking big money. We're talking about, I think the evidence is there. It's just got to be marshaled together. It's got to have good expositors who can explain it and point out the, as Lydia Miller said, that the facts are there. They've just been pushed into the background and ignored.
Some of the evolutionists use this, as I call them, that so rely on chance. So they run their supercomputer for a very basic computer program for 68 days, and the supercomputer, with its very basic 80 kind of program, all of a sudden starts to create design. It looks like it starts to create design.
But that's nothing.
So my question then is, doesn't it make some sense? As they move down this path of religious belief in chance, to apply some resources to say, yeah, but you ran your supercomputer this way, why don't we direct some resources to good computer science and say that's okay?
That any of these systems actually occur. You get to take a look at the others who've done similar things. Instead of the astronomical numbers that now achieve, it requires, you know, in terms of length of time, in terms of levels of complexity, where you have to get it. So, you know, to the extent that data is sitting there, that, you know, to a large extent, the data has out there. The information is there in sufficient quantities. It's simply a refusal to accept the paradigm shift. It's a desire to willfully want to believe in a system that I think everyone's pretty good understands what is problematic. I think the next horizon in terms of biology that's coming up is ideas we're going to have to take a look at is this whole idea of master rate for humans. Now that the genetic code has been largely deciphered and people begin to understand the assembly, they're finding master switches, if you will, that control whole banks of genes, turn them on in sequence and up development, where you turn on, you know, multiple genes, just the right order, just the right sequence, just the right timing. One slight aberration leads to lethality or leads to some, very, very detrimental mutation. And so, those things are additional levels of complexity that I don't think have been really explored or appreciated. I think that's on the horizon for the next decade. But it's not going to change the picture, and it's simply going to continue to reinforce this. Whether it will be persuasive to individuals who wish to hold a view, and to spurn an idea that we can have a supernatural explanation for the origin of life, I'm not sure it's going to be persuasive.
I think the fact is, postulating a God is just totally distasteful to people who want to have their own way of wanting. And I think you can't get around it. But, you know, my profession is modeling, computer software development. As I work through this, I see areas where I'd love to model. I'd love to model. Which, of course, you know, would be substantial efforts. But I guess my evangelical question is, would they really, well, they might advance science, but would they really serve the evangelical cause? And I guess, of course, if it even changes one person's heart, then that might be worth it. For myself, my urgent desire is to put this together in some way that is understandable in your book form or something, and do my little part. And I don't think I'll be building that big model. If that's what I want to know. Although I probably could. You know, 30 years ago, that would have been something I would really have wanted to do. Yeah. My real heart pang is not for the, maybe I shouldn't say it this way, well, I'll say it this way anyway. It's not for the secular scientist. My heart pang is for the Christian who has a totally distorted attitude towards what science is all about and has been fed a, what I would call malarkey about creation and what the Bible requires you to think about creation, that has the result of just totally blocking out any possible consideration of science like we've been talking about today. That's my real ache. And I don't have an answer. Maybe somebody else does. I'm not an administrator. I'm not a propagandist. I just sort of do my thing, as Marilyn will attest. I mean, I like nothing better than having my nose stuck in a computer day in and day out.